Hey guys, welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I am Bill Barnwell. Today, it is a solo mailbag show. Wanted to get some of your questions hitting free agency, hitting some of the new rules the league has implemented over the last week, and kind of just figure out what's happening there and figure out if there's questions to ask. You guys had some really good questions. I'll be honest with you, really some interesting stuff that I've wanted to hit at one time or another, maybe with a guest, maybe hit in a column, but perfect place to hit it here. So let's just get started. And I will start with a question from Leo Talbot, who asks, could you foresee a future where a rookie first rounder might demand a no trade or no franchise tag clause in their first contract? I don't really see any other way to work around the franchise tag. And this is a great question to start with. This is a big picture financial topic related to the cap, both related to the draft as well, related to free agency with how the franchise tag prevents players from getting to free agency. And so when you think about first round picks, we normally think about their contracts as being 4 years because that is the four guaranteed years you get as a first rounder. Typically, first round contracts, pretty much to my knowledge, all guaranteed. Once you get past the first round, you're signing a 4 year deal without a fifth year option, which we'll get to in a minute, but you're not having all of the money guaranteed up front typically. So what it really is, as Leo points out, is more of a 4 year contract with 3 1-year options for the team, because you have the fifth year option for first round picks that pays you a significant raise, to be fair. I mean, the first rounders this year are getting anywhere from, I think, maybe $7 or $8 million on the low end for someone like Najee Harris, who has not been very good as a pro. No disrespect to Najee Harris, I guess, but at a position in running back that does not typically get paid all that much, to upwards of $20 million if you have some Pro Bowls in your past or you play a position that is significantly valuable. So someone like Justin Fields, I believe, has a fifth-year option north of $20 million. So that's something. The franchise tag, of course, is also something, but you're not getting that sort of multi-year guarantee. You don't have a lot of negotiating leverage until you get past year seven, because that's the point where you hit a third franchise tag, which nobody has been willing to do so far for any player. It would be astronomically expensive given the current economic landscape. Don't think teams see that third franchise tag as a realistic thing they would ever use, unless you are, I don't know, Patrick Mahomes or somebody. So realistically, when you sign in the NFL, if you are a superstar and your team just does not like you and does not want to give you a multi-year deal, you have to perform for 7 years before you can hit free agency. That's most of the vast majority of players don't even last 7 years in the NFL. So you can see the frustration there. To answer Leo's question, though, it's difficult because of how the league typically treats rookie contracts. It is really a precedent-based system. So basically, you take the contracts are slotted in terms of each pick value. So you are basically getting, you know, a guaranteed amount of money, or a defined amount of money, I should say, based on the cap and based on where you are drafted in the NFL draft. It doesn't matter if you're a quarterback, wide receiver, guard, running back, tight end, whatever you play, you're getting a flat number that increases every year for the rise in the salary cap. But we don't typically see teams negotiate that figure. Now, what we do see teams negotiate on are some of the minor things in terms of how much of the contract after the first round is guaranteed, how much of it has offsets. So the idea that you could get cut or traded and maybe double dip, that's been a place where teams have fought with agents in the first round here and there over the past few years. To insist on a no trade or a no franchise tag clause would be a significant leap. And there's not really anything to give back as part of those negotiations, because rookies don't have a lot of leverage. If you're a rookie first rounder, I guess you could not report. I guess you could hold in at camp. It would be really difficult, though, because you're so far from free agency that you'd have to be willing to sit out for years to have that make sense and have that be a thing that's suitable for your football team. Now, you could have an owner who says, I'm willing to give that no trade or no franchise tag clause. I don't know why they would do it. They'd be very foolish for them, but great for a player. And, you know, typically when you see not only in football, but in other sports, when you have no trade or no movement clauses, you usually have to give something back. Usually you have to take maybe a little less money up front or a little less guarantee. You can't really do that with the slotted draft slots. So I think Leo's argument makes total sense. I think it would be great if there was a way to trigger that as part of your rookie deal. Maybe if you make the Pro Bowl or you become an all-pro player, maybe that would be a way to get them paid quicker, especially at positions where you don't typically get paid very quickly, like running back or like tight end, for example. But the NFL has carved out the value of this franchise tag, and I don't anticipate that going away. If the players were not able to get the franchise tag off the market for giving up an extra game, which they did for the 17th game, I find it hard to believe it's ever going away or ever going to change dramatically. But you never know. The football evolves and certainly could change in the years to come. Scott asks, what is the over-under on how many playoff games will be decided by a bad hip drop penalty? And this is a common trope I have seen this week. People hate the new hip drop penalty. It is asking more of refs. It is creating some prerogative. The fine system has been seen as very frustrating. We've seen players, the NFLPA first, before it was enacted, and now players past and present have come out. I know J.J. Watt was one of the most prominent players who came out against this penalty. Richard Sherman has said negative things about it as well. And all those players are smarter than me, so I respect their viewpoint on how hard it is going to be to tackle in the NFL. Here's what I'm going to say. You can maybe tell I don't agree. If you listen to me on Around the Horn earlier this week, you can say I don't entirely agree. I do think that using this as a pretense to fine players is not going to be a positive thing. I don't think NFL players need to be fined more. I don't think that is a positive. Yes, there will be bad calls. It is a new rule. There are inevitably going to be bad decisions because any rule in the NFL results in bad decisions. But I don't think this is going to be as dramatic of a change as people are making it out to be. I have seen the research, I've seen the evidence for how it has been officiated in the National Rugby League, the NRL, I think that's the National Rugby League, I could be wrong, but the NRL in Australia, which the NFL is basing a lot of their sort of evidence off of because they've seen that rule get enacted in Aussie rugby, and the rule in the NFL is very similar in terms of the steps you have to take to garner a penalty. It is not just a penalty if you tackle someone and fall on their legs. It is not a penalty if you tackle someone from behind. You have to do three things in succession or in combination to get the penalty. And that is not something that happens commonly with these tackles. So there are a lot of penalties I have seen going around Twitter, a lot of tackles I have seen going around Twitter, I should say, where people have either said, this is going to be a penalty, or is this going to be a penalty? And in the majority of cases I've seen, those would not actually be penalties if the NFL is enforcing this per the NRL's rules. And yes, there will be a game, maybe a couple games decided by penalties. There have been games decided by bad pass interference calls. Doesn't mean we should not have pass interference penalties. There have been games decided by bad holding calls. Doesn't mean that we should throw out holding and not have any holding. And to me, the NFL's evidence, the anecdotal evidence we have on the outside, has been that these penalties create injuries a disproportionate amount of the time. And to me, if we have a game that is decided by a bad call, that will be a bummer. I will not love that. But is it any better for us to lose Tony Pollard's prime because Tony Pollard gets a brutal hip drop tackle on him and it leads to him getting injured as he did in the postseason and then took a major step backwards last year? Is it better for the Ravens to have Mark Andrews at 100% or close to 100% in the postseason instead of having what they had from him this year because of a hip drop tackle on him as he was about to score? To me, those egregious penalties, those are the ones that are going to be called. And those are the ones that should be called. And to me, the league is better without those specific kinds of penalties. Will the league call it perfectly? No. But I think the benefits here are going to outweigh the disadvantages in the long run. And we won't really see that. You know, you don't get to see what tackle would have happened if it weren't for this penalty. So There's going to be some negative feedback, negative blowback when a game is decided by a bad call. But I would keep in mind that there are going to be more players healthy into the postseason because of this rule, if it is called remotely close to correctly. Tim Timothy, interesting choice by your parents for your first name, says, no time ticks off the game clock during a kickoff touchback. With the new rules strongly encouraging returns, how many fewer scrimmage plays per game does this mean for offenses? Good question. And we will see how the league enforces the clock rules. My guess is it will take about 10 seconds off of the clock, which depends on what kind of play is called. For a run play, that's one play. If it's going to be an incomplete pass, you're going to get two plays in 10 seconds. So about 1 to 2 fewer plays per game for offenses, I would guess. But you're also going to end up with better field position as a result of these kickoffs. Touchbacks, I believe, going to the 30 as opposed to the 35, if I'm not mistaken, based on the rules and how they evolved over the course of the last few days. So you're going to have that those drives after touchdowns with shorter field position relative to the end zone. So that's going to increase scoring. It might reduce the number of plays because you are closer. You might not have as many plays, but certainly positive expected value in terms of scoring points relative to where they were under the prior kickoff rule, where you got the ball at the 25 after a touchback. So a trade-off, different. I don't know if it's better or worse in terms of offensive infrastructure, but certainly something the NFL will monitor, and we'll see if that continues to have an effect as the league changes the kickoff rules. This podcast is proud to be supported by Jets Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jets is better with the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country. There is no competition. And right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to JetsPizza.com to learn more and find a Jets Pizza location near you. Again, try Jets Signature 8-Corner Pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's number 8, S-A-V-E. Jets Pizza. Better because it has to be.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Daniel F. asked a question about a specific team that I think is very interesting this offseason, the Tennessee Titans, who... He says, what are your feelings on the Titans' 5.5 win total at the sportsbooks right now? I have not checked this. I will take Daniel's comment at face value. I will assume they're at 5.5 wins. Seems low with the moves they've made, but I also understand the skepticism of the new regime and Will Levis overall. Fair point. That is the nicest way I can recall someone saying sportsbooks are wrong, and maybe they are. I think what Tennessee has done this offseason is really interesting. So I like some of the additions they've made. Chinobe Awuzie is a good player who was playing at an all-pro level before he tore his ACL in 2022 and then wasn't really healthy seemingly until the end of 2023. L'Jarius Sneed, love L'Jarius Sneed. I've talked, raved about him all year in terms of what he's done against top receivers, wrote about him in the Super Bowl, talked about him on NFL Live last week. He is a game changer on defense if he's anything close to the guy he was in Kansas City. I like Lloyd Cushenberry. I think Tennessee needed to upgrade their offensive line. Bill Callahan coming in under his son, Brian Callahan, is such a boon for that team. And I think getting an excellent center is a huge improvement for Tennessee relative to what they had last year. At the same time, Calvin Ridley deal, it's a lot of money for a guy who has been a number one receiver once in his NFL career. The Kenneth Murray deal is just bad. I mean, this is a guy who was not good at any point with the Los Angeles Chargers, a player they had to hide more often than not. I think they are they're acquiring him based on his college pedigree. I don't think he's had the pro tape or pro performance to justify any sort of meaningful deal. So that did not thrill me. But to get back to this win total, it has to be around Will Levis and the tackle situation, right? I mean, they have probably one of the worst tackle situations in football on paper right now. And Will Levis, I know Tennessee fans are excited. I've seen plenty of hype for Will Levis and Tyjae Spears, and maybe all those guys will turn out to be great. This is a team that's had a few bad drafts under John Robinson, a team that did not get a ton out of Will Levis last year. Did not, you know, well, everyone in the NFL pretty much passed on Will Levis. Doesn't mean he's not going to be a star. Doesn't mean he can't turn into a good player, and he's going to have more around him this year than he had a year ago, certainly in terms of receiver. But this could be a you're going to have to prove it to a situation for sort of people looking at Tennessee this year. I assume they're going to go tackle at the draft. They desperately need to. If they can get Joe Alt at 8, that'd be great. Don't know if the Chargers are going to trade down, if they're going to take a tackle at 5. They could certainly, even though they have Rashawn Slater at left tackle. So that's a possibility. But you would figure a left tackle in the first round would be better than what they had last year with Andre Dillard and various backups on the left side. So I would probably go over 5.5 wins. They were a 6.7 win team last year with Mike Vrabel. And I think there's probably some element of losing Mike Vrabel being baked in, and Mike Vrabel being such a good coach for Tennessee over the last few years in terms of game management and all that good stuff. But I would still lean over 5.5. I think they're probably not as good as maybe Tennessee fans are hoping. But to me, I think a 7-win football team. Outside Zone Pod asks, both the safety and running back positions have seen swings in demand and contract types lately in free agency. Which position group, let me paraphrase if I misquoted here, which position group will be talked about in the same way in 1 or 2 years? So these two positions are different. I know that there has been a couple different situations here where last year running back really seemed to stagnate, and there was a collection of backs who stuck in the market until late in the summer. This year, safety has been that position where outside of Xavier McKinney and one or two other guys, it's been a lot of veterans settling for one-year deals. You still have guys out there like Justin Simmons who are super valuable. So I have to differentiate here because they are in two different spots. So the running back market, wrote about this after Saquon Barkley and others signed that first day in free agency. The market for running backs is not like any other in football. So what's happened has been the running back market has basically stayed stagnant or even gotten worse in a lot of ways while the salary cap has grown. So their deals don't really count any, or sorry, don't count is the wrong way to put it. Obviously they count. Saquon Barkley is making life-changing money and good for him. But relative to the increase in the salary cap, their deals are so much smaller than players at other positions or what they were in years past. So go back to 2011 when Adrian Peterson signed his extension with the Minnesota Vikings. That is as far as my database goes for signing multi-year deals for NFL players. His extension, in terms of average annual salary, was about 12% of the salary cap at the time. He was about $14 million a year in 2011. To put that in perspective, if someone was going to sign a similar deal to Adrian Peterson under the current salary cap, that would be a running back making $30 million per year. That is what running back markets, the top of the running back market was like back then with guys like Adrian Peterson and Chris Johnson. Right now, Saquon Barkley's deal, Josh Jacobs' deal, they're sub 5% of the salary cap. And that's what guys like Doug Martin and Lamar Miller were getting in free agency over the course of the last decade. Those are not the sort of, you know, top tier former franchise backs like Barkley, like Lamar Miller. Now, doesn't mean running backs won't get that. Jonathan Taylor didn't get that. Maybe Christian McCaffrey, if he signs an extension with the Niners, might get that. I certainly hope that these backs get paid, but we've seen even this year, as those guys have signed contracts, they haven't been for significant money relative to what the cap currently is. And there's been a lot of holes in the deal. Josh Jacobs's 4-year, $48 million deal is really a 1-year, about $14 million contract with the Packers and then a series of options for Green Bay. So we will see. Safety, on the other hand, has risen not as fast as the cap, but has risen to the point where there are some much more significant deals in terms of percentage of the cap. Derwin James, Jamal Adams, when they signed their extensions in recent years, they were getting more than 9%, close to 10% of the cap. So I think this year is an exception for safety because there's just so many options. There's so many talented safeties who hit the market, and teams were willing to be a little more creative and willing to sort of take a shot on who the other safeties were going to be available. Now, Outside Zone Pod's question was what other positions might come into play here. I think tight end and off-ball linebacker are the two that come to mind for me, but they're more like safety than they are like running back. Running back is on an island to me in terms of how it's changed and evolved. And we'll see. I mean, clearly teams who were not interested in paying running back significant money were more open to it this year. The Eagles signed Saquon Barkley. The Ravens signed Derrick Henry. There is an equilibrium being found here where backs are, you know, certainly having a great back is worth more than having a replacement level back. And I think teams are not going to go back to a world where they're not paying offensive linemen as much. I think the money that went to running backs has mostly shifted towards offensive linemen being sort of the driver of a running game as opposed to the back himself. I don't think that's going to change, but something we'll have to monitor in the years to come as the cap continues to rise. Joshua Ray says, who is a player who would have gone down as an all-time great kick returner with the new kickoff format? Great question. And it's interesting because we're going to see teams approach this in different ways. Like with the old kickoff strategy, it was kind of one archetype, right? Like it wasn't as if teams were running a lot of different sorts of kickoff return plays. But with this new kickoff system, you're going to see teams be more aggressive. You're going to see teams run a wider variety of concepts. You're going to see teams block different ways. You're going to see teams ask the returners to do different things. You're going to see some teams have one returner back, some teams having two returners back, as we talked about last week with Kevin Seifert on our podcast. So it's going to change, but I think the meta, at least early on, is going to be for sort of a one-cut runner who has the acceleration to burst through and make a big play. And I think any of the good Shanahan zone scheme backs would work, but the guy who comes to mind for me is Eric Dickerson, where if you watch an Eric Dickerson highlight reel, man, I mean, it's not Barry Sanders. It's a different kind of style of back, but it is just the acceleration is otherworldly, and just the size to fend off tackles, the speed to run away from people. When he hit the hole, he was gone. And I think that's the, you know, prime Eric Dickerson would have been terrifying on kickoff returns. Mr. K asks a rather wonky question, which I like. Can you explain in simple summary salary cap rollover? If the Patriots, as an example, have $100 million in extra salary cap room, they have that next year to use in addition to the normal salary cap? That seems crazy. I would think it is capped or there are some limitations. So essentially, yes. Now, if you go to SpotTrack or go to Over the Cap and see what a team's cap number is, they don't carry over every dollar of that amount. There's elements related to a team's draft class that might not carry over depending on how much they spend on the draft. There's different incentives and things that come into play in terms of what's likely to learn, what's likely to be earned, what's not likely to be earned. There's elements that you can't carry over in terms of cap space. But in the big picture, yes. Yeah, essentially, you're carrying over the majority, typically, of what you have available for the upcoming season. Now, a couple of distinctions to make here. Is it likely a team will have $100 million in extra salary cap space? Not really. It's not really a logical thing to do if you want to carry over that space, because the cap space means more now than it does the following year or the year after that or year after that because of inflation. So $100 million in cap space is better to have now than better to have 3 years ago. Now, you want to find a balance. You know, the Saints are a team that is very aggressive in saying cap space now is worth more than cap space later. You always want to strike a balance between those two things. But we haven't seen teams roll over quite that much. I haven't gone through every single team, but one that comes to mind for me are the 2020 Browns, who rolled over more than $35 million, which was about 16% of the cap space that year, into 2021. And they were able to spend a lot of money and go out and sign, or trade and sign, Deshaun Watson, which did not especially go well for them. Right now, the Patriots, to bring up the team Mr. K mentioned, have about $48 million in cap space. So that's about 19% of the current cap. They'll probably spend a little bit more, probably get in that 15% range, but they can certainly roll that amount over. And I really think it's not that big of a deal, just because you have a lot of flexibility in how you structure deals, how you use the cap, how you go about your spending. It's not that hard to structure or restructure a deal to use current cap space or extend it to the future, but you can roll it over, yes. And I think it seems like a bigger deal than it actually is, because in the NBA, if you could roll over cap space, that'd be incredible, right? If it was hockey, the same thing. In the NFL, just contracts are so different that it's helpful, and certainly it's a meaningful thing, but it's one of those things, like with the salary floor, that I think people on the outside probably think a little too strongly about in terms of it mattering all that much. Leo, a different Leo, the Leo we started the show with, I believe, asks, why do teams ignore the compensatory pick formula? Why are you, not me specifically, but why are NFL teams giving random guards $100 million when Cody Whitehair is right there to be had? Simmons, Justin Simmons, I'm assuming he means, and Eddie Jackson are just as good as the safeties getting 3 to 4 year deals. Good question. And it's a valid one. And again, is Cody Whitehair as good as Robert Hunt, the offensive lineman who the Panthers signed to a 5-year, $100 million deal? Not so sure. Are Justin Simmons and Eddie Jackson as good as, you know, Xavier McKinney? They're different. These players, Whitehair, Simmons, Jackson, all on the older side for NFL teams. And I think we saw teams really focus on signing younger players at those positions, like guard at safety to significant deals. McKinney is in his mid-20s. Hunt, Damian Lewis, both the Panthers signings coming off of their rookie deals. That does matter a lot for NFL teams, especially when it comes to giving out a multi-year deal with a multi-year guarantee as opposed to a one-year deal for less money. But Leo's point is taken. I do believe there's a thing with NFL general managers, depending on how you evaluate players, depending on what your background is, depending on how desperate you are, that teams will get hung up on specific players or specific traits more often than you think. And again, it's a balance, right? Like you can't just plug in any safety or any guard and get the same results. What kind of scheme do you run? What are you looking for out of players at that position? Do you need a guard who is bigger because you're going to be running more gap schemes and you're going to be running more duo, more power? Or do you need a zone blocking guard because you're primarily a zone blocking team? Do you need a smaller, more athletic guard? That comes into play. If you're a safety, you need a safety. Do you want a safety who is comfortable playing single high in center field? Do you want a safety who's more comfortable in the box making tackles? Do you want a safety who is versatile and can do both? Do you want a safety who can cover? Does your system not typically ask safeties to cover all that often one-on-one? Like, those are all valid questions that lead GMs and lead coaches and lead executives towards specific players. But I would say that good organizations, I think organizations who do play the comp pick game are relatively smart relative to the opposition. I think they are less likely to get hung up on one individual player and more traits that different players have or traits that different draft picks have. And I think lesser organizations or bad teams are more likely to get hung up on specific players because they love the player. They loved him in college. They love him. He had a great game against them. Lots of different reasons why teams fall in love with specific players. And I think evaluating the market and understanding what players are going to get is an incredibly important skill for general managers. And some teams do a much better job of this than others. And so you'll see teams go out and sign somebody in day one in free agency for significant money. And it turns out the market for those teams and for those players is nowhere near what they were expecting. And the Patriots, with Bill Belichick, who's a genius, were a good example of this a couple of years ago when they went out and signed Nelson Aguilar to a significant deal on day one of free agency when pretty much the entire wide receiver market tanked. So that's part of the job. You have to not just evaluate players, but also evaluate the replaceability of those players, how many similar players are going to be in the market, what you're willing to accept, and then factor in the comp picks as well. So it's not as simple as just saying, you know, don't sign players who don't impact the comp formula, but you have to be smart about, you know, how rare is this one particular player? What are the chances he's going to live up to our expectations? And how much of a premium is that worth if it means losing a comp pick in the process?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Tay Morgan asks, can a team overinvest in a position? For example, there's often talk about teams not wanting to get a high-priced free agent edge or wide receiver because they already pay big money to another player at the same position. Is that something teams really worry about, and should they? Great question. Is that something teams really worry about? It depends, right? I mean, are you going to be upset if you have two great edge rushers? I'm skeptical, especially if you don't have a player at that position already. Is it something teams think about with lesser positions? Do they want to spend a lot on two guards or two linebackers or two safeties? It's tougher, but we've seen teams do it and justify it, right? I mean, the Panthers just spent a ton of money on two guards. They had Luke Kuechly and Thomas Davis, two expensive linebackers that made it to the Super Bowl. The Bills had two expensive safeties in Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde, and that was transformative for their secondary. So can't fault that, you know, anything can work philosophically, but I think like anything, it's okay. Well, what are you, you know, what does it cost you elsewhere on your roster? And a good example of this is when the Cardinals traded for DeAndre Hopkins. I remember I gave that deal, I want to say an A minus or an A for the Cardinals, but not an A plus. And there were people mad at me. I mean, I did not say nice things about Bill O'Brien and the Texans in that trade. I think that holds up, but you know, the one concern I had for the Cardinals is that they had invested a lot at wide receiver. They had DeAndre Hopkins. They had Larry Fitzgerald on a big deal. They had Christian Kirk, who at that time was, I think, a second round pick who they just used. They had Andy Isabella, who they just had a second round pick on. They had used a fourth round pick on Akeem Butler, I think the top of the fourth round, if I'm not mistaken. They had used a lot at wide receiver, and they had major holes, significant problems elsewhere on their roster. Up front, at cornerback, their offensive line wasn't very good. None of that would preclude you from stealing DeAndre Hopkins from the Texans. And I would never argue that they should not have made that trade, but it does limit you in terms of what you have elsewhere on your roster. If you're using a ton of capital at wide receiver, you're inevitably going to have a weakness elsewhere you're going to try and fill with lesser players. And I mean, the Niners, I think, are really good at how they evaluate players, Trey Lance deal aside, but they're great. They have a great roster, and they when they sign free agents, they're usually quite good. But you could see it's not just Deebo Samuel, it's not just George Kittle, it's not just Christian McCaffrey that they've used significant draft capital to either. No, they didn't use significant draft capital on Kittle. Kittle was a fifth round pick, but Christian McCaffrey, they trade three picks for first round picks on Ayuk, second round pick on Deebo, you know, significant draft capital using those players. It's not just them. I mean, they used high picks on Dante Pettis, on Tyrion Davis Price, on all kinds of players who are part of the equation there. And you can understand why Kyle Shanahan would want to, you know, sign those guys or use those guys. You can understand that that offense is so much fun, but that does come back to haunt you. Trading three first-round picks for Trey Lance and having it not work out turns about to haunt you. We saw in the Super Bowl, I mean, they did not have a slot corner because they moved Logan Ryan to slot because they didn't trust Ambry Thomas. They kept Diamondar Lenoir outside, and Ryan was the one in coverage on that game-ending touchdown pass to Mecole Hardman, and they were not communicating well in the secondary. The Marquez Valdes-Scantling touchdown was a blown coverage, which... We could, or it might have been Oren Burks filling in for Dre Greenlaw. It might have been Gibson. Hard to say. Combination of the both, maybe. But you got the idea. Like, when you invest a lot in something, you have to make cutbacks elsewhere. You either have to go out and sign a free agent and hope he fills in, which we know free agency is a very risky and often difficult proposition to pull off. You have less depth on your roster. You have to get by with mid-round picks as opposed to, you know, using your first-round pick on a player in a position. There's nothing wrong with taking those risks. And at the end of the day, you want great players, no matter what position they play. And you can win with all kinds of different roster constructions. So I don't think it should stop you, but I do think you have to recognize that you're going to have to make mistakes. You have to make mistakes, but have to take riskier decisions elsewhere. And when you try to do everything, you end up with a roster that's just torn apart, like the Eagles at the end of the Carson Wentz era is a good example, where they were trying to just fill hole after hole and ended up missing out on players because of it. James asks, what is the context, or where is the context in draft and free agency discussions? I've recently listened to a podcast that used Kyle Pitts' lack of impact as a reason to not draft Brock Bowers early while ignoring the lack of quality quarterback play in Atlanta and Pitts' knee injury. Fair point. Is this the way NFL GMs think? I can't speak for every NFL GM. I've certainly spoken to several, a fair amount, past and present. I've spoken to plenty of people who work for NFL organizations. And the answer is sometimes. It depends on the situation, how significant it was, how obvious of it comparable it was. But we certainly do see general managers act as copycats or get caught up on one recent comparable. At the same time, a conversation that we may have on the outside about a player, whether it's on a podcast, whether it's on television, it may get expressed in a simpler anecdote publicly, and there may be more truth to it with a bigger picture evaluation. So tight end is a good example. The attrition rate for tight ends is higher than it is for the vast majority of other positions. I know we've seen Travis Kelce play into his mid-30s. He is the first tight end in NFL history to have a 1,000-yard season as late in his career as he has. Tony Gonzalez is an exception. Jason Witten is an exception. There's so many other great tight ends who did not make it that far. Antonio Gates, Rob Gronkowski, guys like that come to mind. It is a brutal position to play. And first-round tight ends have generally been less productive and offered less of a return than players at the vast majority of other positions. So there is a concern. And then on top of that, with Brock Bowers, tight end is one of the least expensive positions to fill for any team in football. And so you're getting less surplus value by using a first round pick on a tight end when the cost of the first round pick is exactly the same, whether you're drafting a tight end or a offensive tackle or a wide receiver or a quarterback. So your upside is capped by taking someone like Brock Bowers. Now, would I want to take Brock Bowers? Yeah, Brock Bowers is a hell of a football player. And if you think he's going to be a franchise tight end, there's not a franchise caliber player at a more expensive position or more valuable position out there, I think you should take him. But when we have these sort of discussions, it's tough, right? Like, you know, you don't want to spend an hour or 2 hours on every single thing. But when I'm writing a column, for example, it's easier for me to be more nuanced about a situation than I am with a podcast or a television hit. It's just the reality of where we have those conversations. And from the NFL team perspective, you know, an anonymous quote you hear from a scout or a quote at the combine, there's usually, not always, but usually more nuance to those evaluations than maybe what you hear publicly. So I would never say GMs are perfect or geniuses, because they do make plenty of mistakes. And I have heard some logic for NFL team decisions, and it can be absolutely just, how can I put this nicely? Dumber than you would imagine at times. Not often. Most NFL GMs don't always agree, but they're generally pretty smart people. The decisions have a lot of logic behind them. I would never say that the vast majority of decisions have no logic or have logic that would not pass muster in a fantasy league, but that does happen. So I'll just leave that there. Matt asks a very different kind of question. What is the best food city? I don't know what kind of range we're looking for here in terms of, do we get the entire world? What kind of food are we looking for? Are we looking for variety of food? Are we looking for just food at a high level? We're looking at street food, Michelin-starred food. I mean, it's such a Such a wide-ranging, simple question. I am biased and say that when I lived in New York City, I grew up there. I spent time there as an adult. That was the place I felt like I had access to the widest range of food at a high level. I have not lived in Tokyo, although I've been. I've not lived in Paris, although I've been. I would argue that the food there is immaculate. And had I lived there, I would probably feel the same way about those cities. I know other people who have recommended other places. I don't think LA qualifies for me. Sorry, LA. I don't know that like a city like Houston, as much as I love, you know, the stuff in Houston, in terms of what I can get in terms of Tex-Mex or barbecue, I don't think that is on the same level in terms of other stuff. I really think it depends. Like the most boring answer, the most honest answer is, like, what do you like? What are you looking for? And to me, I think that drastically changes what kind of city and what you'd be looking for. If you're a big Mexican food fan, New York is not the place for you. There is good Mexican food in New York, especially now, but like, go to LA and go to Mexico City, go to, you know, go to Texas, you will find much better Mexican food than you will in New York. And if you want stuff that is good in New York, I can tell you firsthand, there are places elsewhere where you will, even great food cities where the food, even good quality stuff, good pizza, you know, good bodega stuff is not on New York's level. So it depends, but I would say New York City. DJ1212 asks, how have top quarterback prospects with elite receiver talent in college like Jaden Daniels done in the NFL? And I think the answer is pretty good. Like, you know, obviously it's not perfect, but I don't think that would stop me from taking a quarterback. I mean, go back to recent drafts. Joe Burrow had Justin Jefferson and Ja'Marr Chase at wide receiver at LSU, which is unfair. I mean, imagine having those two guys on the same team in the NFL, let alone at the college level. Joe Burrow turned out to be a pretty dang good NFL quarterback. He, of course, has had help in terms of having Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins at receiver, but hey, pretty good. C.J. Stroud last year, I mean, he had Marvin Harrison Jr. for a year. He had Chris Olave, Garrett Wilson, an embarrassment of riches at Ohio State. C.J. Stroud entered Houston with didn't have a Ja'Marr Chase on his roster. He had Nico Collins. He had Tank Dell. He had John Mechie. He had Dalton Schultz. Man, C.J. Stroud looked good last year, and he made those guys look like stars. So I'm not saying C.J. Stroud made guys at Ohio State look like superstars because of his talent, because those guys are also great. We've seen that elsewhere. But I wouldn't stop myself from taking a elite receiver, early quarterback, heading into the NFL, or a quarterback who looked elite heading into the NFL, even if they had elite receivers. To me, I think you're evaluating a quarterback independent as much as you can of receivers. You know, I want to see, okay, what's his footwork like? How is he, you know, how does he adjust against pressure? What is he, you know, how does he go through his progressions? What does he see when those receivers are doubled? Like, yes, if you have a wide receiver who's going to bail you out on 50-50 balls, it's going to help. It's going to go a long way. And that is valuable, but I think we have enough in terms of recent quarterbacks who have succeeded with elite wide receivers at the college level who have translated and done well at the NFL level. Last question here from Derek Podshin. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, who asks, how many deadline day trades would it take for an NFL reporter to tweet, good Lord, the way Woj did in 2015? I mean, Woj is an absolute master on Twitter. I would never be willing to say that an NFL reporter can tweet on Woj's level when it comes to what he does on deadline. But that day, I think I did a podcast a decade ago now with Robert Mays, where we had three trades break while we were taping the podcast. I mean, I think it was Sam Bradford got traded, and then the Jimmy Graham trade to the Seahawks happened. That would be part of it. If the Christian McCaffrey trade had happened and the Brian Burns trade had happened to the Rams on the same day, maybe that would have qualified. I think the difference is with the NFL during trade deadline day, McCaffrey got traded. That's a huge player. Von Miller got traded. But like, we don't see quarterbacks get traded. Like, if the Cowboys start 2-4 next year and we see like six trades and then Dak gets traded, at the trade deadline, okay, I think that would get a good Lord. So if that happens, I promise you, Derek, I will tweet good Lord and I will shout out the legend Woj while I do so. All right. That's it. Really enjoyed these questions. Hit some big picture stuff. I think some of the things we take for granted that we don't necessarily talk about. I think some eval stuff, some conversations about how we look at players, all interesting to me. Hope you guys enjoyed it. We'll have more audio coming over the next month. Some really cool stuff dialed up here. We're going to have some draft coverage, but in a unique way. I think thinking about not just this year's draft class, but how we evaluate drafts in the big picture. Going to talk with some of the smarter folks here at ESPN and elsewhere to break down all that stuff. So hope you guys enjoyed today's show, and more audio on the way next week.